for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Dave DeForest reporting. There's been a deadly attack in Pakistan. Authorities say at least 49 people were killed, more than 50 wounded today, in a bomb attack at a Shiite mosque in Sindh province. Several of those wounded were in critical condition. A splinter group of the Pakistani Taliban claimed responsibility. Iraqi Kurdish forces have repelled a major attack by Islamic State fighters in Kirkuk province that killed a senior Kurdish commander today. Officials say at least 8 Kurdish fighters were killed. Edward Uranian has more on today's fighting.
Kurdish Peshmerga fighters exchanged volleys of automatic rifle fire with Islamic State militants Friday south of the oil-rich city of Kirkuk. The surprise Islamic State attack bore witness to the group's resilience despite a series of setbacks in both Iraq and Syria. Islamic State militants also detonated a car bomb inside Kirkuk in a failed attempt to break into a prison by breaching the walls of the city's police headquarters. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
The African Union today endorsed plans for a regional force of 7,500 troops to fight the militant group Boko Haram. Word of the endorsement came at the AU, or as the AU opened its annual summit in the Ethiopian capital Addis Ababa. Nigeria, Cameroon, Chad, Niger, and Benin recently agreed to work together against the militants who have killed thousands of civilians in Nigeria and control large parts of Borno State on the borders with Cameroon and Lake Chad. AU Peace and Security Council Commissioner Shmael Shergui said the plan will be submitted to the United Nations Security Council. This is VOA News. The African Union has chosen Zimbabwe's president, Robert Mugabe, as its new chairman. The 90-year-old Mr. Mugabe replaces Mauritania's president, Mohamed Ould Abdelaziz. The announcement was made during the African Union summit in Ethiopia. The Zimbabwean president addressed the crowd.
By electing me to preside over this august body, with the full knowledge of the onerous responsibility that lies ahead, I humbly accept your collective decision.
President Mugabe, the man known in South Africa as Prime Evil, has been granted parole after 20 years in prison. In the time of racial apartheid, Eugene de Kock headed a covert unit that was responsible for the deaths of dozens of people. Justice Minister Michael Masuta said de Kock would be released in the interest of nation building and reconciliation. He noted that de Kock had expressed remorse for his crimes and had helped authorities find the bodies of some of his victims. He was arrested in 1994 after the end of apartheid. The families of a Japanese journalist and a Jordanian military pilot continue to await word of their fate. Another deadline for a possible prisoner exchange passed with no word from the Islamic State group, which is holding the men. Republican Mitt Romney, who lost the White House to President Barack Obama in 2012, has announced he will not be running for the office in 2016. The former Massachusetts governor made the announcement in a conference call with supporters today. Officials in Moscow say Kim Jong-un will attend celebrations in Russia in May, marking the Soviet victory over Germany in World War II. Brian Patton has a report. Well, apparently we're not going to be able to bring that to you. At least 12 people have been killed in eastern Ukraine within the past day as the result of fighting between Ukrainian troops and pro-Russian separatists. Local officials said at least 7 civilians were among the victims of today's violence. The latest fighting has centered on a town where rail lines converge to connect the separatist-held provinces of Luhansk and Donetsk. Shelling also took place in the city of Donetsk, injuring at least 23 people. The appeals chamber of the International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia upheld genocide convictions against 2 senior Bosnian Serbs for their roles in the July 1995 Srebrenica massacre. The appeals decision issued today affirms their life sentences. That's the harshest punishment ever delivered by the court. From the VOA News Center in Washington, I'm Dave DeForest.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
The number of new Ebola cases in West Africa is dropping, but the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says the fight against Ebola is not over. The organization warns that complacency could lead to preventable deaths.
That's Lisa Schlein reporting from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva. Details coming up.
Also in the news, the African Union today endorsed plans for a regional force of 7,500 troops to fight militant group Boko Haram.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Douglas Mpuga sitting in for Sunny, music from Cameroon and our daily features, so stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon today called for the immediate and unconditional release of school children kidnapped by the Nigerian militant group Boko Haram. He said the world is appalled by the brutality of Boko Haram, which poses a clear danger to national, regional, and international peace and security. Mr. Ban made the comments at the opening of the AU summit in Addis Ababa. We'll have more on the summit and its response to Boko Haram shortly. In other news on Nigeria, troops and warplanes from Chad are reported to have driven Boko Haram from a Nigerian border town. Chad and Cameroon recently deployed forces to combat Boko Haram, which has seized much of Nigeria's Borno state, including a key multinational military base at Lake Chad. A Nigerian military spokesman using Twitter said Nigerian forces took part in yesterday's attack against Boko Haram. Meanwhile, many residents in neighboring Adamawa state have fled their homes after a string of deadly attacks by the Islamist group. During a campaign rally, Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan sharply criticized those who accused him of supporting the insurgency in Adamawa State. He said only mad people would make such accusations.
The African Union has elected Zimbabwe's President Robert Mugabe as its chairperson, dismissing the objections of civil society and human rights groups. The 90-year-old leader takes the position as the AU seeks solutions to the Boko Haram insurgency, violence in South Sudan, and the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. VOA's Gabe Jaslow reports.
Mr. Mugabe took over the rotating chairperson position Friday at the start of the Heads of State Summit in Addis Ababa. The Zimbabwean president brings decades of experience to the position as one of the few modern leaders who was present at the founding of the Organization of African Unity, the predecessor to the AU, more than five decades ago. In his speech to the summit Friday, Mr. Mugabe said the ideals of the organization's past should influence its future course, saying he would put particular emphasis on issues of climate change, agriculture, and infrastructure development.
As we move forward with this noble agenda, we must emulate and draw inspiration from the principled stand and selfless sacrifices that our forebears made to bring us a strong and united Africa that we are so proud of today.
But Mr. Mugabe also brings with him some baggage as a leader who has often been criticized for clinging to power and brutally suppressing his opposition. Amnesty International released a statement urging Mr. Mugabe to use his one-year term as chairperson to address human rights concerns, including within his own country. Mr. Mugabe, who famously ordered the seizure of land owned by white farmers in Zimbabwe, also turned up the anti-colonial rhetoric while urging the continent to better protect its own natural resources.
African resources should belong to Africa and to no one else except to those we invite as friends. Friends we shall have, yes, but imperialists and colonialists no more.
Mr. Mugabe replaced Mauritanian President Mohamed Ould Abdel Aziz as AU chairperson. While the theme of this year's AU summit is women's empowerment, much of the official agenda and sideline meetings have focused on security issues, especially the Boko Haram insurgency in Nigeria. AU leaders called for a regional military force of 7,500 troops to fight the insurgents based on a model that has been deployed in Mali and Central African Republic. AU Commission Chairperson Nkosazana Dlamini-Zuma said the threat calls for a collective, effective, and decisive response.
The senseless killings, the destruction of property, the enslavement and sale of our people, especially girls, kidnapped and married off, the terrorization of villages are a threat to our collective safety, security, and development.
Regional leaders are also searching for a solution to the civil conflict in South Sudan, bringing together the warring factions to try to reach a power-sharing agreement in the coming days. Thousands of people have died in the conflict, which began in December 2013, while numerous attempts at a peace agreement have so far fallen through. The East Africa Group of Nations, IGAD, is to hold a summit Saturday in Addis Ababa with South Sudan's leaders to try to forge a lasting deal. Gabe Joslow, VOA News, Addis Ababa.
Thank you, Gabe. The incoming chairman of the African Union, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe, says it's not possible that women can be at par with men. While he made this controversial comment in Addis Ababa on the eve of the AU summit, many are debating what the 90-year-old leader meant by the statement. In an attempt to understand, VOA's Anita Powell spoke to an internationally recognized Zimbabwean human rights lawyer who happens to be a woman and brings us this report from Johannesburg.
Mr. Mugabe's remarks on women not being on par with men, fittingly, come as African Union leaders tackled this year's summit topic, women's empowerment. He spoke to VOA Zimbabwe Service reporter Sandra Nyaira on the sidelines of the summit in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia.
When it comes down to the ground, it's not easy for them. They get married. They must have babies. They must look at all the children. That's the problem. I'm saying it's not possible that women can be on a par with men. You see, women, we want children. We make the very women we want in Parliament pregnant. Yes, and we remain it. It's not possible. That aspect only.
It's not entirely clear from these comments alone whether Mr. Mugabe is lamenting the longstanding inequality of women and calling for change, or if he believes that this is the natural order of things. But it would not be the first time Mr. Mugabe, who turns 91 next month and has spent more than three decades in power, has courted controversy on gender. In 2013, he insulted his political enemies by calling them mere women. Muddling the picture further, Mr. Mugabe went on to call for equal pay for women and for better maternity benefits.
They must be paid if they are employed. They must be paid for that period and not for, you know, companies or government to say, we will give you only 3 months. It must be 9 months, right?
One of Zimbabwe's top human rights lawyers, Beatrice Mtetwa, is a woman. Her first reaction to the president's comments, which VOA News played for her, was incredulity and peals of laughter. But, speaking to VOA via Skype from Harare, she said if he meant that women should be inferior, that is no laughing matter. And Zimbabwean law, she says, supports equality.
I don't believe the president could say anything like that. I mean, someone is pulling my leg. That is not possible for the president to say that because there is a constitution that he signed only in 2013 and made into law, which basically gives women in Zimbabwe every possible power and every possible equality clause with men.
She also notes that if Mr. Mugabe's comments were meant to denigrate women, then they effectively disqualify Mr. Mugabe's rumored successor, his wife.
So if he had any illusion that he might be powerful, respected political leader, she must go back into the maternity ward and start making more babies.
So what did the president mean? Was he bemoaning centuries of subjugation and calling for change? Or is he reminding women to remember their place, which is apparently not in the halls of power, but in the home? Or is he reiterating what women around the world have heard for centuries? Families and careers are not compatible, and in the opinion of men, family comes first. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
The Islamic State group's affiliate in Egypt says it is responsible for a series of attacks on security personnel in the Sinai Peninsula yesterday that killed at least 26 people. The province of Sinai says it carried out multiple assaults that took place within hours of each other. Officials say the insurgents fired at a military base and a hotel in the town of Al-Arish, where police and military officers live. Egypt's major government newspaper, Al-Ahram, says its office directly across from the military base was destroyed. It did not say there were any casualties in the building. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, according to a statement today by the president's office, has cut short a visit to Ethiopia for the African Union summit in order to return to Cairo to deal with the latest developments. Another attack yesterday, suspected militants killed a senior army officer at a military checkpoint in Rafah. Islamic extremists based in Sinai have attacked and killed hundreds of police and soldiers since the pro-Islamic president Mohamed Morsi was overthrown in 2013 and arrested by the military. The province of Sinai group was known as Ansar Biyat al-Maqdis until late last year. It changed its name after swearing allegiance to the Islamic State.
You're listening to African News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. With Yehia Swuhib, I'm Kim Lewis in Washington. Well, the number of new Ebola cases in West Africa is dropping, but the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies says the fight against Ebola is not over. The organization warns that complacency could lead to preventable deaths. Lisa Schlein reports from Red Cross headquarters in Geneva.
For the first time since June, the World Health Organization said fewer than 100 new cases of Ebola were confirmed over 1 week in the countries most affected by the epidemic, Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone. This is certainly good news, but the International Red Cross Federation is warning against a false sense of security. The head of the agency's Ebola Coordination and Support Unit, Beert Hald, says the epidemic is far from finished.
It's really important that we keep the attention on this problem, otherwise we will risk that it becomes endemic. It's clear also we are at a stage where some of the curves are bending, but they may flare up again, so it's really too early. But we need also to start thinking about how to support recovery, especially recovery within the health sector and structures, because weak health structures were actually the main reason why the epidemic was able to spread the way it spread in those particular three countries.
Hall says cases of Ebola continue to appear in Sierra Leone and Guinea, so suggestions that the epidemic could be over as early as May must be treated with caution. She was based in Guinea for many months and notes many cases of Ebola go unreported there. She says the hostility of some communities against health workers, especially in remote areas of Guinea, remains a matter of great concern. She says Red Cross volunteers are unable to access some areas because of the resistance, which sometimes turns violent. The Red Cross has a network of 6,000 volunteers in West Africa actively involved in the Ebola response. Hald says these volunteers are well-placed to provide a rapid response to new outbreaks of the disease. She tells VOA the Red Cross is adapting its strategy to the changing course of the outbreak.
There's not so much need for treatment anymore and focus on that. And as the numbers of people dying from Ebola is going down, we will retrain our volunteers so that they can actively engage in social mobilization and contact tracing and contact finding, actually, even more active, to have a much more agile and proactive role. We will make rapid response teams that can immediately be sent out to new districts when new cases appear.
The Red Cross Federation says stopping Ebola is not enough. It says the current emergency response will produce lasting effects only if the root causes of this epidemic are tackled. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Amnesty International is calling for the release of 8 people being detained in Sierra Leone following an Ebola-related riot last October. The human rights group says at the very least, their case needs a judicial review. The 2 women and 6 men were among 34 people arrested in the eastern region of Kono. Amnesty says the detentions followed an executive order issued by President Ernest Bai Koroma under his state of emergency powers. 26 people were later released. Sabrina Matani is the West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. From Dakar, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua about last October's incident in eastern Sierra Leone.
What we understand is that there was a local politician whose grandmother, around 90 years old, was suspected to have Ebola, and he protested to have her taken to the hospital. At that time, Kono Government Hospital was known to have quite a lot of deaths happening due to Ebola. And over this sort of protest, many people who supported him came out to sort of protect him, and this resulted in what we understand to be a riot that happened.
Now, under what charges are they being held?
So following this, around 34 people were held under the state of emergency, and an executive order was passed by the president. All the executive order states is that these people were detained because of national security. They've been detained for over 3 months. There's no file in the prison, no charge, and there's no release date. So effectively, they're being held indefinitely.
Why were the 26 of the 34 later released and not these final 8?
Unfortunately, we're not sure as to why that is, and I've not been able to get any clear answer on that.
Have you or any other group contacted the Sierra Leonean government about this?
Yes, a local organization, Advocade, which is a women's rights organization and provides legal aid for women, wrote to the president requesting their release. That is the first stage that the Sierra Leone Constitution provides in terms of the safeguards. The president is supposed to confirm whether he will release these detainees or not. And then the next trigger is that there should be an independent tribunal to review the detention. But to date, they wrote on the 9th of January, there's been absolutely no response from the authorities as yet.
Have you visited any of the detainees?
Yes, I was in Sierra Leone about 2 weeks ago, and I was in the female prison, and I did speak to 2 of the female detainees there.
And what is their condition?
They're being held in the maximum security prison, the female prison. It is one of the better detention facilities in Sierra Leone. But, of course, they're very concerned because they have no real knowledge about why they've been arrested. They've never been interviewed by the police, and they're not sure when they will be released. They're also being detained in Freetown, the capital, but they're from Kono, which is about 8 hours' drive away. So they're very worried about their families and their children.
Now, Amnesty International says it is concerned about police accountability. Do you believe that was an issue in this case?
Yes, we've heard many reports that 2 people were shot dead during the riots. We have understanding that the police fired live ammunition to try and dispel the riots. And no serious investigation has been conducted into these killings of these 2 people. In the past, Amnesty has also raised this issue around police accountability. For example, in 2012 in Bumbuna, a female protester during a peaceful protest against a mining company was shot dead by the police. And to date, there has been no arrest. So this is part of a wider issue around police accountability in Sierra Leone that we have been highlighting.
These arrests were made under rather extraordinary conditions in Sierra Leone, namely the Ebola outbreak, which has killed thousands of people.
We do very much appreciate what a challenging time it is for Sierra Leone and other countries affected by Ebola. And Amnesty has also been doing a lot of work in trying to raise more awareness about the international response and the need to commit resources. But at the same time, we do feel that in a state of emergency, human rights must be protected. And under African Regional Human Rights Charter, this does not allow for derogation of fundamental human rights even during a state of emergency.
Sabrina Matani is the West Africa researcher for Amnesty International. From Dakar, she spoke to VOA's Jody Kepua.
The World Food Program says it must cut its assistance to Uganda by half due to a shortfall in funding. The move will impact some 150,000 Ugandans living in refugee settlements. Elizabeth Pula reports from Kampala that $30 million is needed to continue the needed level of assistance.
In recent years, Uganda has become a major hub for the region's refugees. Instability in the DRC and conflict in South Sudan has caused the number of those escaping violence to swell to more than 300,000. These are the largest numbers the WFP has ever worked with in Uganda, and it is causing incredible strain. On January 27th, the WFP announced they will cut rations for certain refugee groups in Uganda by 50%. The cuts will be rolled out according to length of stay, targeting those who have been here at least 3 years or longer. Those who are disabled, unable to seek work, ill, or elderly will still receive their full rations. Deputy Country Director of the WFP, Michael Dunford, explains the need for targeted cuts.
So prior to this ration cut, we would have broken across all of our commodities by April. So particularly in light of the uncertainty that is either happening north of the border or west of the border, we needed to kind of build up some contingency stock. In addition, you never want to run out completely because otherwise the refugees have nothing. So it's better to gradually reduce, ensure that there are provisions to meet the needs of the most vulnerable, to continue to provide something to those who are longer term, and to ensure that there is a contingency should we have a dramatic increase in numbers as a result of what's happening externally to Uganda.
Although the Ugandan government has one of the most progressive refugee policies in the world, providing refugees housing settlements, plots of land, freedom of movement, and access to employment, hundreds of thousands still depend on daily food rations supplied by the WFP. Michael Uwino, who handles food distribution at the Rwamwanja refugee settlement, says people are upset by the cuts. Rwamwanja in the southwest of Uganda is home to nearly 20,000 refugees, mostly Congolese nationals. An average ration for a refugee is around 2,100 kilocalories per day. Under the new program, it will fall to around 1,000 kilocalories per day. Uwino told VOA the refugees are afraid the food they're receiving is not sufficient to sustain them for a month. 95% of refugees in the camp rely on the food for their daily rations. Although he has explained to them why the food ration was cut, most say they don't know how they will survive and are afraid of their children starving. Food distributors are concerned adults will skip meals in favor of feeding their children. The WFP requires $7.6 million per month to operate in all 9 settlement camps throughout Uganda. The organization is hoping that increased commitments from donors will help stave off food scarcity issues that, if not addressed, will start to affect all refugees, including new arrivals, by April. Elizabeth Pola, VOA News, Kampala, Uganda.
This is Africa News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is a public service announcement from VOA Africa. Former U.S. President Jimmy Carter addressing the Ebola crisis.
Hello, I'm Jimmy Carter. I would like to talk to you about stopping Ebola. Ebola spreads mostly by close contact with a person who is sick with Ebola and funeral practices that involve touching of bodies. Please help health workers check on people who have been in close contact with an Ebola patient so they can get health care at the first sign of sickness. Working together, we can stop Ebola.
This was a public service announcement from VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. The AU today endorsed plans for a regional force of 7,500 troops to fight militant group Boko Haram. And, quote, it's not possible that women can be at par with men, unquote, says the incoming chairman of the AU, Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Coming up, we have music from Cameroon, and in our feature segment, next, efforts being taken to control or eliminate malaria, river blindness, and elephantitis. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehia Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports is next. Time now for the mighty Douglas Mpuga with sports, sitting in for Sonny Young today. And happy Friday, Douglas.
Happy Friday, Kim.
What's on tap today?
Well, Kim, we start off in Japan.
All right, let's go.
Yes, thank you. Four runners who have gone under the elite benchmark of 1 hour, including the defending champion, Martin Mutati, will be on the start line of the 69th edition of the Kagawa Maragame Half Marathon and IAAF Silver Label Road Race on Sunday. Mutati won last year's race within 1 hour 11 seconds, the Kenya's fastest half marathon since 2011, when he recorded his personal best of 58.56 at the Great North Run in the north of England. However, the fastest half marathon runner in the quality field is Bernard Koech, who recorded 58.41 in the 2013 San Diego half marathon. However, the San Diego is downhill and point-to-point in nature, so his fastest half marathon on a standard course is 59.10 at the 2012 Little Half Marathon. Koech has run a total of 5 half marathons under 60 minutes. The other sub-60 men are Eritrea's Samuel Segai and Tanzania's Fabiano Joseph. Segai recorded his best when he finished second with 59.21 at the 2014 IAAF World Half Marathon Championships. Joseph, the 2005 World Half Marathon Champion, recorded his best of 59.56 back then and may not be in the same form as the others. Other contenders will be a contingent of Kenyans living in Japan, Paul Kuria, Edward Waweru, Jacob Wanjuki, Benjamin Gandu, and Enoch Omamba. The battle for the top Japanese runner is likely to be between Masato Kokuchi, Keita Shitara, his twin brother Yuta Shitara, and Akinobi Murasawa.
On Africa News Tonight, we let the sound tell the story, putting you in the middle of events from Africa's news to world crises. Africa News Tonight comes to you live from the Voice of America, Monday through Friday at 1600 and 1800 UTC on the following shortwave frequencies, 6080 kilohertz, 49.3 meter band, and 15580 kilohertz, 19.2 meter band. We are also live on the internet at www.voaafrica.com.
Now let's join Daybreak Africa's Marco Uma in Johannesburg, South Africa, for more sports news, starting with the Africa Cup of Nations.
Guinea has advanced to the Nations Cup quarterfinals at the expense of Mali following the random draws conducted at the Hilton Hotel in Malabo on Thursday. Guinea and Mali tied in second place at the end of their Group D preliminaries. The tournament organizing committee then followed Article 74 of the Orange Africa Cup of Nations regulations to determine who advances and who goes home. At the draws of the lot, Mali Football Association President Boubacar Diarra drew the ball marked 3, while Guinea Sports Ministry Finance Director Amara Dabo drew the ball marked 2. Hence, Guinea progressed to the last 8. This method of settling a deadlock has previously been applied on 2 occasions. In 1972, the then Nations Cup hosts Republic of Congo advanced at the expense of Morocco, while in 1998, Algeria progressed as Ivory Coast went home. Staying in Malabo, acknowledging that this is not the best way to resolve this matter, the CAF Communications Director, Junior Binyam, told the media on Thursday that they were compelled to abide by the laid-down regulation. He says CAF will explore the possibility of an alternative system to separate teams that find themselves in such circumstances in future. On a more cheerful note, the quarterfinals gets underway with a Central Africa derby featuring the Republic of Congo playing the Democratic Republic of Congo in Bata tomorrow Saturday. This match will give way to the showdown between Tunisia and hosts Equatorial Guinea. On Sunday, the spotlight returns to the capital Malabo, where Ghana play Ivory Coast before Guinea challenge Algeria. Finally, the Confederation of African Football, CAF, and the United Against Malaria campaign have renewed their partnership, CAF revealed in Bata. They continue work on spreading messages aimed at life-saving malaria prevention and treatment. Mali's Seydou Keita, Ghana's Andre Ayew, Cameroon's Nicolas Nkulu, and Ivory Coast's Gervinho are prominent players romped in to lead the campaign.
Thanks, Mark. That was Daybreak Africa's Mark Ouma in Johannesburg, South Africa.
African Music Mix.
Are you wandering around lost in a musical desert? Well, follow your ears to the fantastic, the one and only African Music Mix on the Voice of America. Bathe yourself in this musical oasis. North to the south and from the east to the west, the African Music Mix plays only the best. Tune in from 0 to 300 hours UTC and from 11 to 1300 hours UTC every single day on the Voice of America.
This is the Sunny Side of Sports, and we're coming to you live from Washington. Ethiopians dominated both the men and women events at the recent Standard Chartered Dubai Marathon. The energetic Andy Edwards was there and caught up with longtime Ethiopian star and legendary Haile Gebrselassie. Here is Andy Edwards.
We're in conversation with one of the great ones of track and field, Haile Gebrselassie. We're in Dubai, and Haile has shown one of his many skills, that is, as a co-commentator on TV, but we've been celebrating tremendous running from the Ethiopians. Leminu Behanu Haile, not a very well-known Ethiopian, must be said, has broken through to win the men's title. And Aselefeh Mergia has come back from having a baby to win her third Dubai title. And Haile has watched them both. Let's take the men. Your namesake, Haile, Behanu Haile. Tremendous run from him to beat Lelisa De Sisa, who's really experienced, isn't it?
Yes, it is. What I was expecting, you know, around the 35-37K, I thought, you know, just Lelisa is going to win, you know, the race. But what you see, you know, just from Haile, he was very strong. He looks very relaxed. And the kilometer 40, what I said, you know, this guy, you know, is going to win. Because, you know, just... First, when you run a marathon here in Dubai, you don't need to be, you know, experienced athlete. Mostly, you know, just who won the race, who ran, you know, first marathon. Same thing what happened today. But the only thing, you know, just when we come to the tactic, you know, it was a bit tactic, you know, it's a very tactic race, you know, just especially the last 3-4 kilometers.
They finished okay outside the men's course record, but it was wonderful racing, wasn't it? I mean, for me, both this and the women's racing marathon, we saw runners giving everything, and it's the peak of athletics.
Exactly, especially when you run a marathon, nothing left, you know, just in your body. It's normal. Well, one thing, what you don't complain at the end of the marathon, because of you run the marathon. It's a marathon, it's 42K. And if you ask everyone who finished the marathon, what is your regret? Nothing, because of a marathon.
Let's come to the women's race. I mean, for a long time, we had an Ethiopian-born runner running for Bahrain, Tifis Tufa, out there in front. She'd won Shanghai last November. She ran 2:21 there. But she was running 2:19 pace and leading a really good field by 2 minutes. Did she go out too soon?
Exactly. Her mistake was, you know, just to start very soon, very early. Shouldn't be like that. She should stay, you know, with the group. Well, finally she paid the price. And you see the other, I mean, especially at the last part, you know, it's getting warmer. That's, you know, just hard, you know, just to push alone. You need somebody to assist. If you look, you know, just a group of women who running behind her, they were, you know, doing a right job with the pacemaker.
A fine win, though, and a third in Dubai for Aselefeh Mergia after having had a baby. She's a really quality athlete, isn't she?
Yes, she is. Today, I was, you know, just scaring a lot, you know, just during the race, because Cherino, she's a very, a very fast runner. She ran, you know, good for half marathon, and but Merga, she used her experience. She knows, you know, just the Dubai course, and she's also a very, very strong fighter. And plus, you know, she ran in front of her husband, her little baby. Just only, you know, just a year and something, and a year and a half. It's wonderful. And plus, you know, they are both, you know, the husband and wife, they are my friends, and I'm so happy. I'm so excited, you know.
It certainly was a family celebration. And also worth noting, Gladys Cherono of Kenya, she's a world half marathon champion, but this was her debut marathon. She finished second. She almost beat Mergia. She's one to watch, isn't she?
Exactly. Watch her, you know, just the next marathon. You know, she's strong. I mean, I don't expect, you know, just the first marathon to run such. Almost she won the race. Don't underestimate, you know, just about this athlete. You know, the only thing was she made the experience.
One more question, Haile. You're looking as fit as ever. You're clearly a very busy man, the way you're in demand here in Dubai. Are you, I mean, if we say Haile Gebrselassie now, businessman, runner, is that the way to term you?
I'm doing a lot here in Dubai, you know, just things what I have done, you know, just since they start the marathon is a lot. But, you know, I wish, you know, just to run a marathon. Of course, now I'm switched to a business, and I'm doing a lot, you know, just in my business, over 1,600 people to work in the company. And, you know, I'm doing a farm, school, hotels, fitness center, cinema, a lot, and selling cars. Many small things make, you know, big business.
But do you still reserve some time to run each day?
Of course, every day, early morning, 5:30, I am in training.
That's the way we all should live our lives. Haile Gebrselassie, thank you very much for talking to us. Thanks very much, Haile.
Thank you.
Andy Edwards, thanks a lot. That's the energetic Andy Edwards reporting from Dubai. In tennis, top seed Novak Djokovic beat defending champion Stan Wawrinka in another dramatic five-set contest to reach the Australian Open final. The Serb won 7-6, 3-6, 6-4, 4-6, 6-0. The third year running, they have played five sets at Melbourne Park. Djokovic, chasing a fifth Australian Open title, will play Britain's Andy Murray in the final on Sunday. He beat Scott, who is in his fourth final at Melbourne Park, to claim the 2011 and 2013 titles. However, Murray will have taken some encouragement from the length and quality of the second semi-final. The third installment of Djokovic-Wawrinka did not hit the heights of the previous two, with a combined 118 unforced errors and 12 breaks of serve. And that's it for this edition of the Sunny Side of Sports. I'm Douglas Impoga. Now back to you, Kim.
Thank you, Douglas. And listen to Sports Monday through Friday at 16:31 UTC and 18:31 UTC. And today, the Mighty Impuga has an expanded half-hour edition of Sports at 17:30 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, creating a mobile phone application as a way to preserve folk stories in Nigeria. And next, efforts being taken to control or eliminate malaria, river blindness, and elephantiasis. But first, some music. Here is Benji Mateke of Cameroon with Africa Raga.
Angwa! This is Mr. Papi's call. Coming out with Mr. Benji Mateke. I want to send a message to all the children on the floor. This is special song to make you respect your mothers, respect your fathers, respect everybody that is here around your road. You gotta praise him, give your time, because he needs to give you every difference. Listen to my message right now.
Tonja monu loa sangwa oe, tonja penu dipi nyangwa o, abi ende na ebo manda kusinoni kae, ebo manda kusinoni kae, bo na bana woro senga e. Tonja monu loa sangwa oe, Tonja penu di pinyangwa o abi endena ebo manda kusinoni kae ebo manda kusinoni kae bona bana wolo senga e
ewo beba belalo solo
eyo di mabula ne eyo di mabula ne eyo di mabula ne bana batene ne basango pinde
abana o
eyo di mabula ne eyo di mabula ne eyo di mabula ne bana batene ne basango pinde
oyai muno me ayadie oma ya pe muno kusindutuwe kama suma ponda nde mabeni njomi e Onde ma beni njomi wo bona bana wolo senga e Oyai muno me ayadie oma ya pe muno kusindutuwe kama suma ponda nde mabeni njomi Onde ma beni njomi bona bana wolo senga e African Raga.
Cameroon's Benji Matike with Africa Raga.
While the age of smartphones and mobile technology, some Africans worry that oral traditions will be lost to internet connections and social media. This has led one Nigerian woman to create a mobile phone application as a way to preserve folk stories. Kristen Roby has the story from Abidjan.
For centuries, Africans have preserved their history through storytelling. But communication is evolving as more and more Africans use smartphones. So Nigerian tech entrepreneur and fashion designer Elizabeth Kapurin decided to adapt African folk tales to the 21st century, and she's focusing on children's stories that teach moral lessons. She created AfroTales, a mobile application to preserve some of the stories told to her when she was a child sitting around the campfires at her home in eastern Benue State.
Sometimes you can't teach a child something by just telling the child, don't do this, don't do this. It, in fact, it gave me context and a story. Somebody stole something and then something bad happened to that person. Alternatively, somebody else did something good and the person ended up really happy or really rich.
Hello, children. My name is Liz and I would like to tell you a story about a tortoise, an elephant, and a hippopotamus. This story will tell you why it is important to go to school so you can grow up to be very wise like the tortoise in the story.
AfroTales is designed for children ages 2 to 10. The voice of Aunt Liz narrates the story while a full-screen animation appears. An arrow indicates when it's time to move on. There are also quizzes on object recognition and counting throughout.
Can you point at Mr. Elephant? No, try again. Good! Find the rope. No, try again.
Capern relied on her older relatives to help collect Teve stories from an ethnic group of 4 million people in southeast Nigeria and northwest Cameroon. Eventually, she would like to include folktales from other parts of Nigeria in various local languages.
I want to keep it centered around folk stories. I don't want popular stories like, let's say, the ones that Walt Disney has made really, really popular. I think it's only fair and respectful that we keep certain cultures alive, because most of these folk stories are part of the tapestry that keeps cultures together.
Capern is responsible for voicing and script writing. Her partner and husband, Adimebi Elamina Eremi, does the animation, a love story sparked during their creation of the app. AfroTales is available for Android users and can be downloaded for free on the Google Play Store. So far, AfroTales has more than 50,000 users. Funding has been a major challenge, so Capern hopes to capitalize on the popularity of the first installment with a crowdfunding campaign. Capern says technology doesn't have to destroy or replace tradition. Her mission is to blend the two to keep African culture alive.
Africa is our home, you know. I think we are so in a rush to become Western that we're forgetting things that are really, really important, things that should be part of who we are. And I don't think that's right.
The second Afro Tales is due to be released early this year. Kristen Roby for VOA News, Abidjan.
Diseases such as malaria, river blindness, and elephantiasis continue to cause immense suffering, disfigurement, and often death in many parts of the world. Yet many of these diseases are little known today in the West. A new museum exhibit in New York highlights these diseases and what the Carter Center, among others, is doing to control or eliminate them. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
At a press preview for the Countdown to Zero Defeating Disease exhibit at the American Museum of Natural History, former President Jimmy Carter noted that many diseases, such as polio and malaria, no longer affect people in the U.S. and Europe.
But they affect hundreds of millions of people in the poorest nations on Earth, particularly, I'd say, in sub-Saharan Africa and also, of course, in Latin America and other places.
Many in the West have not even heard of several of the worst diseases in those places, says Craig Withers of the Carter Center.
People know about polio, they know about malaria, but they don't know about other what are now referred to traditionally within the public health community as neglected tropical diseases.
Information about river blindness, a tropical parasitic disease caused by the bite of a certain species of black fly, is prominently displayed at the Countdown to Zero exhibit. 99% of the estimated 120 million people at risk for river blindness live in Africa. Semi-annual drug treatment has nearly eliminated the problem in Latin America, and health officials hope for similar success in Africa. The exhibit also highlights a devastating illness called lymphatic filariasis, commonly called elephantiasis. It threatens almost a billion people worldwide. Withers says it's caused by a mosquito-borne parasite.
You're bitten by a mosquito, and the parasite goes into the lymphatic system and starts to block it. Its primary manifestation is enlargement of the limbs, primarily legs, but it also can affect the genitalia. We did a study in Nigeria, and we found, I want to say, 40% of the men in the rural districts had enlarged scrotum.
Withers adds that in Africa, the mosquito that causes elephantiasis also transmits malaria. Mosquito bed netting and one effective pharmaceutical cocktail of two drugs is helping to control both diseases. One disease that the Carter Center has helped to nearly eradicate is guinea worm. It's caused by a parasite within a crustacean that thrives in the rain ponds many rural Africans depend on for drinking water. President Carter says that in 1986, when guinea worm eradication efforts began, there were over 3.5 million cases of the disease. Now, Carter says there are only 126 known cases of guinea worm left in the world. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at www.voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our African News Tonight producer, Kwame Ofori, and our engineer, Peter Hundley, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Warring factions in South Sudan have agreed in principle to end the conflict that has caused the deaths of thousands of South Sudanese citizens. Now is the time to put these words into action. The United States, together with its Troika partners, the United Kingdom and Norway, calls on the parties to use the upcoming Intergovernmental Authority on Development Summit on January 29th to secure peace. In the face of the deplorable humanitarian crisis in South Sudan, there can be no excuse for further delay in negotiations or for continued violence. We commend the IGAD and its special envoys for their steadfast commitment to the peace process and welcome the strong message from People's Republic of China Foreign Minister Wang Yi calling on the parties to make peace. We recognize the agreement signed January 21st in the northern Tanzanian city of Arusha, which constitutes a roadmap towards unifying and reconciling the three factions of the ruling Sudan People's Liberation Movement. But we have been deeply disappointed in the continued unwillingness of the parties to make the compromises needed to achieve a viable peace agreement. Over the past 2 months, their statements have suggested they have distanced themselves from previous commitments, and violations of the cessation of hostilities agreement have continued. We call on the parties to recommit to negotiate with a spirit of urgency and compromise, refrain from all further military action immediately, and form a transitional government of national unity. Over a year after the beginning of the conflict, nearly 2 million South Sudanese have been displaced. Over 100,000 are under the direct protection of the UN mission in South Sudan, and the country remains at risk of a food security crisis. Along with other international donors, we will continue to stand with the people of South Sudan, who are needlessly suffering as a result of this conflict.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. For a transcript of this and other VOA editorials, or to receive editorials by email, visit the VOA Editorials Internet homepage at voanews.com/editorials.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. Please join me Monday through Friday at 16:30 and 18:30 UTC. And on Fridays, you can also hear my 30-minute show at 17:30 UTC. On the internet, like me on Facebook, follow me on Twitter, and read my blog. Check voaafrica.com for the addresses and enjoy the show.
Hello, I'm Sunday Shomari. Next on Let's Talk, In Love.
The nose is a topic we'll discuss in our new light-hearted show, Let's Talk. So join me, Sunday Shomari, and my guests as we explore in lows with some hilarity. That's Let's Talk